Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions and the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. In this episode, I interview Damian Real. Damian is an attorney and technologist with VLEX, a new AI legal research assistance solution for attorneys. While not a practicing attorney, Damian shares his perspective on why billing time isn't the most profitable way for lawyers to bill clients, and he makes an excellent case for why you don't want to be late to the game when it comes to ditching the billable hour for alternative fees. Longtime listeners know I've been releasing videos of my podcast to all of my Substack subscribers. Go to lawsubscribe.com and join the Substack using the form on the homepage. I'm speaking at ABA Tech Show in Chicago this February of 2024, where I'll be presenting on generative AI and the subscription model and podcasting for lawyers. Register for that at techshow.com. Thanks, as always, to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel. Links to both in the show notes. More on them later. And remember to use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. It lets them know you found out about them from the podcast. You get 10% off, and it really supports the show. Another way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Damian, thanks so much for coming on the Law Subscribed podcast. I'm so happy to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I know you've been making the rounds in the legal news and legal tech news sphere, but just in case my listeners haven't come across one of your very recent appearances yet, go ahead and just give a quick background.
Sure. My background, I've been a lawyer since 2002. I litigated with a large law firm, Robbins Kaplan, and my full litigation career was about 15 years where I did things like representing Best Buy and much of their commercial litigation. I represented victims of Bernie Madoff. I helped sue JP Morgan over the mortgage-backed security crisis. So high stakes, bet the company kind of financial fraud and other business litigation was what I did for many years. But I've also been a coder since 1985. So I have the law plus technology background that I really brought to my practice. And then in 2015, I pitched Thomson Reuters with an idea. I said, here's legal tech I think can change the world. You should build it and hire me. And they were dumb enough to do that. So I worked with a team of many, many coders and lawyers building this really big thing that I can't talk much about for Thomson Reuters. But then my next cool gig was working in cybersecurity, where my company, Strauss Friedberg, was hired by Facebook to investigate Cambridge Analytica. So I worked on Facebook's campus with Facebook's data scientists and my former FBI, CIA, NSA people that worked with me to figure out how bad guys use Facebook data. I did that Monday through Friday for about 57 weeks in a row. And the stuff we would do on Monday would make the New York Times and the Times of London by Friday. So that was a really cool gig that I left to do my next cool gig, which is right now. I worked for Fastcase in 2019, and I essentially had a playground of a massive data set where I was able to do data science and be able to extract the things that matter from that massive data set of 700 million documents and dockets to be able to provide insights. And then in March of this year, Fastcase merged with VLEX. And so now I not only have US data, but I also have worldwide data. So I have, UK data, I have EU data, I have Latin American data, I have Asian Pacific data. So we have over a billion documents worldwide that I get to run data science across and run large language models across.
And I'm going to recommend to all my listeners and link to it in the show notes. Stephen Poor did a great job interviewing you on Pioneers and Pathfinders about all of that background, but that's not why you're here today.
Indeed.
So with VLEX now, sort of like a lot of companies are jumping on this bandwagon, VLEX has Vincent AI. And I've had guests on the podcast before. We've talked about how AI is changing the legal profession and why the billable hour just doesn't make sense in that world. And so that's why we have you here today. But I think my listeners will understand, because we've had these conversations and when you just talked about the data, the power of the AI is, at least with these large language models, right, is really sort of depends on the models used in the training data. So VLEX has all of this data. Right. So what is Vincent AI and what distinguishes it from sort of the other players that are out there?
Yes, that's exactly right. So in 2015, when I decided maybe I should make the jump from law practice to work for legal tech, I really thought I don't want to work for somebody that doesn't have the data. Mm-hmm. And if you think about, we've known for decades that data is the new oil. And so you need oil to be able to run the data across. And so I thought I went for Thomson Reuters because I thought Thomson Reuters has a massive oil field that I can play in. And so that's why I work for them. And right now, VLEX has arguably an even more broader, deeper oil field. That is, we have 775 million dockets and documents that are filed by lawyers and judges every day across the United States. That's 775 million things that we can be able to, if you think about the oil analogy, that is oil that I can refine that oil with large language models. That is, I can take, here are the 25 motions to dismiss in front of Judge Smith for summary judgment, or motions to dismiss on breach of contract cases. I'm say, take these 25 motions to dismiss for breach of contract cases and synthesize those into a new motion that is statistically likely to win for this judge, for this cause of action, for this court. And or take, you know, take these contracts and be able to synthesize these contracts. You need that oil to be able to run the refining of the large language model across that oil. So yes, data is the new oil. And really, I wanted to always to work for a new oil field. So as your listeners think about who are you working with, you have to say, are they just a refinery without oil? Or do they actually have a massive oil field to be able to refine that data? Because anyone can be a prompt engineer. That is, you know, but because with, you know, GPT-4 and otherwise, it's easy to prompt engineer. It's really hard to get the oil. The oil matters.
Right. And I think that lawyers, whether we call it prompt engineering or not, I think that's not as sexy a term as it could be, you know, but that just might be become what lawyering is. I mean, it's really about what questions are the right questions to ask. And to those of you who watched that very recent Elon Musk interview for the New York Times, if you actually watched it, I didn't just look at the highlights of him saying F you to the advertisers. That's kind of what he talks about, is why he does what he does, is it's about he's trying to figure out what are the questions we should ask. Well, lawyers, as subject matter experts in law, are very good at figuring out what are the questions or prompts we should be asking or prompting, right? So I don't see lawyers going anywhere. I'm not, you know, we're not afraid, you know, the Law Subscribed listeners are not afraid of AI replacing lawyers, because we're going to be using it.
Indeed.
When we're going to be the subject matter experts who are able to get the good results. So and I think lawyers are better off, you know, in light of our training to be good prompt engineers. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think for the savviest of lawyers, they should absolutely be prompt engineers. That is, you should dig into ChatGPT and dig into the other large language models like Claude and Llama 2 and Bard and soon Gemini when it comes out. Dig into those and learn how the technology works so you can be better prompt engineers. So I would say that's path number one. Path number two is some lawyers will never be prompt engineers because they either aren't curious about it, but or they just would say, I just want to practice law. Mm-hmm. And so as a software engineer, I want to be able to satisfy both camps. Path number one of people that want to dig in to be prompt engineers, and also to help people number two that say, I just want to practice law. I don't want to be a prompt engineer. And so with Vincent AI, we've really catered to both, where with Vincent AI, you just ask a legal question, much like you would ask an associate. What are the trade secret implications for a customer or for a salesperson stealing a customer list? That's something you could put into an email, and that's something you can put into Vincent AI. No prompt engineering involved. So we, on our side, essentially do all the heavy lifting of prompt engineering through 20 prompts that you never see that give you really the good results for that. And so that, you know, Sam Altman, who is the CEO of OpenAI, he was asked a question. He said, you know, what do you think about the ascendance of prompt engineering as a field? And he said, oh, God. He said, I hope that prompt engineering is not a thing in 3 years, because if it is a thing, we're doing our jobs wrong. That is, OpenAI isn't doing their work on the back end to be able to say that you don't need to be a prompt engineer to do this work. It'll just know. So in that same way, VLEX, we say you don't need to be a prompt engineer. All you need to be is be a lawyer, and we'll do the prompt engineering on our side.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background that we the users are not even going to see, because then on the front end, even I've seen this with Spellbook, and I've seen this with Paxton, and I'm curious to know if Vincent also does this as well. Is it does suggest prompts to you based on, say, a document you upload, a video, or even like a previous prompt? It may suggest follow up prompts. So is Vincent also in that game as well?
Yeah, so there's current state and there's future state. So with the current state, yeah, a lot of the stuff going on behind the scenes, you often hear of large language models being black boxes, mm-hmm. that you don't know what's going on. You just get the output. And Vincent AI, we are not a black box. We are a clear box where you actually see the system going through four different stages. Stage one is doing the matching between the user's question and the actually matched output of the cases, statutes, regulations, judicial opinions that do the matches. So stage one, you actually see in the clear box all of the text that matches your question. So that's stage one. Stage two is you actually see the large language model telling us how well or how poorly that text answers the user's question. So that's stage two. Stage three is you actually, as a user, see the percentage of score. We ask the large language model, give us 0 to 100% as to how well or how poorly this text answers your question. So you see 100%, 90%, 80%, 70%. So you actually see that there. So that's all clear box stuff. And then from that clear box stuff, you actually get the output. That is, you get the memorandum to answer that legal question. So really, to your point about, you know, not being able to see things behind the scenes, we actually offer that clear box rather than a black box to be able to actually see what's going on behind the scenes. So that's thing number one. Thing number two, as to, you know, you mentioned some of those other companies that they suggest other prompts to be able to say, hey, maybe you'll think about this. That's really trivial. It's really easy to say, you are an expert lawyer. Here's a user's question. Give me five other questions to be able to, that maybe the user might be interested in this. That's three lines of code and one prompt, right? So anyway, so you wouldn't be surprised if you're going to see that with us very soon.
Yeah. And it's just one of these things to get your brain going as an attorney, because I may use those prompts or may just help me think of some other prompts, right? And it is somewhat trivial, because you could also, within a generative AI platform, say, here's my situation. What are some prompts you would recommend? And you get some good recommendations, probably, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's a weird world when the large language model suggests how to use the large language model better. It's a very recursive world.
Yes, a little bit of an Ouroboros, but you know, that's the world we're living in. And there's a whole other like sort of sci-fi route that we could go down with that. You know, anyway, that's a whole other conversation and a whole other podcast. Something you mentioned that seems really interesting to me is what Vincent AI is doing with that percentage and pumping out the memorandum, because what that allows for, which some of these other AI platforms aren't really intentionally pushing in this direction, is still that human, legal-minded analysis, right? That valuable work. Because any person, arguably, could go on to Vincent or some of these other platforms that are not a subject matter expert in law or a licensed attorney, prompt, use the suggested prompts if they're there, and get the same output. But it's then what is done with that, and is it sufficient? Do you need more prompting? Do you need to go down a different path? Like, that's where the lawyer brain kicks in and the value work that we provide. Now, of course, it's not going to take that much time, right? Which brings us back to the theme of the podcast. What have been your thoughts on that? And when you're trying to let the lawyers know and the law firms know about what Vincent AI does, you know, you're coming up against this billable hour model, and they're like, well, I could bill for research. So isn't that cutting against my profits? What do you say to that?
Yeah, so I would say that. So for this, so I'm sharing on my screen, your audio listeners won't be able to see, but here you can see that here's a question, trade secret law regarding former employees stealing customer lists. It's read through actual cases and statutes and regulations, and it gives you the percentage score, that is the confidence score, as to how well the text from the case, in this case, Neville versus Chudikoff, how well does that text answer the user's question? It both answers that textually and then also provides a percentage score as to that confidence score. So to your point about the business of law, what this has done is we've read through hundreds of cases, and then we landed on the 20 cases that have the above 70% confidence. That is, it is above 70% of a score. So really all you're seeing is the 20 highest quality cases that are actually answering your, as a user's, question. So if you think about how long it would take to read through hundreds of cases and then land on the 20 that are most relevant, as well as the statute and the secondary sources, and then take all 27 of those sources and turn it into a memorandum that's about 2 or 3 pages long, it's probably going to take a human longer than the minute and a half that it took for the machine to do this. And so then for those hourly business people, they're like, oh my God, I would have charged my associate would have charged 4 or 5 hours to do that research. And all of a sudden it's in a minute and a half to do that. And so two answers to that. One, to the hourly business people, yes, you would have done that. But think about now, in a minute and a half, question number one is answered. That gives me an associate time to ask question number 2 and question number 5 and question number 10 and question number 20. So maybe in that 4 hour time span, I could ask 30 questions and get the answers to 30 questions rather than just the one question that it would have been before. So for those from the hourly business method, you might still be able to bill 4 hours and then just get a better work product for your end user. So that's thing number one. Thing number two, if you are working on a subscription model or on a flat fee model, that's 4 hours that all of a sudden you shrunk your cost. That is, your associate cost to do this work shrunk from 4 hours to a minute and a half. Yes, they're still going to have to read the cases. Yes, you're still going to have to do the analysis. So maybe it goes from a minute and a half to 15 minutes or 20 minutes, but that's still better than the 4 hours you would have charged otherwise. So either model, whether you have an hourly business model or a flat fee model, this will accelerate either the quality under the business model, where you can now ask 30 questions rather than just the one, or it will give you the efficiency under the flat fee or the subscription model, where you can actually do this work faster, better, stronger than you could have in the past.
So just to be clear, like if I wanted to, I could go sign up as a Vincent AI customer right now and use this technology. It's available.
So we are in a beta test right now, and we are currently working with some of the largest law firms in the world for an enterprise access. And so, yes, go to Vincent AI through VLEX. Yes, sign up for our waiting list, and you will eventually get on. But yeah, there is a true cost to VLEX. That is, OpenAI is charging us money to do these things. And so, but of course, that money that they are charging us is changing precipitously by the day. It used to be for each one of the questions that we asked, it used to be that OpenAI would charge us $3 to $6 per question. So you can imagine if you ran hundreds of questions, that would cost a lot of money for a solo small person. But OpenAI a few weeks ago announced that they're cutting that cost in half, or maybe to 2/3. So now it's only 1/3 of the cost for a lot of this output. And OpenAI is getting competition from Anthropic with their Claude model. And Meta is releasing Llama 2, which is, you know, free and open source. And Google is coming out with Gemini, which is going to be the pants off of GPT-4 if you believe the people within Google. So anyway, with competition in the marketplace, the cost of these things will come down precipitously. And as the costs come down precipitously, we will open up more widely to more people like your listeners.
Yeah, and that's great to know. And also just to point out that, you know, there are firms using this technology right now, which means it's at least in a good, even in beta, it's in a good enough state in terms of the accuracy that firms are using it right now, correct?
That's exactly right. And, you know, people have talked a lot about the hallucination problem that poor Steve Schwartz out of New York realized all too well. And there's you know, on the accuracy point, you can go route number one, which is the Steve Schwartz route, which is to ask ChatGPT out of the box, which is essentially asking from the trillions of documents that ChatGPT goes through, give me a legal answer, and it's going to hallucinate. That's option number one. Option number two is don't ask trillions of documents, but use what's called retrieval augmented generation. That is to be able to say, here are the 12 documents that are most relevant to yours. Here's the 12 cases, statutes, regulations. Take these 12, and now within the four corners of those documents, give me a summary of those. The number of hallucinations for those 12 documents is going to be way, 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 way less than asking the large language model out of the box. So that retrieval augmented generation drastically increases accuracy and decreases hallucinations. So yes, you can, you know, if you think about how often a large language model hallucinates with the retrieval augmented generation route, it's probably going to be less than the first year associate hallucinates in giving a bad analysis of what the cases, statutes, regulations actually say.
Yes, most definitely. And that's been sort of my big push with this is people, well, what about the mistakes? Oh, so humans make no mistakes. Even licensed attorneys make no mistakes. No, of course they do, right?
That's right.
This is why I trust driverless cars more than I trust humans.
That's right.
If there were all driverless cars, right?
GPT 3.5 beat 10% of humans on the bar exam, and then GPT-4 beats 90% of humans on the bar exam. GPT-5, how many of those are they going to be on the bar exam?
Right. And then while mistakes that humans make, we may not call them hallucinations because they don't just make up BS. Some lawyers do. How they get licensed is beyond me. But you know, mistakes are mistakes, right? And we do what we can to avoid them. I didn't have the RAG terminology when I wrote my article for ABA GP Solo magazine, but that's essentially what I said is like, you like restrict the source of truth is what I refer to it as. Like, don't just go in thinking it's a sort, you know, you're going to get an answer. You're using generative AI wrong. That's not what its best use is when you have this powerful tool.
That's right. The large language model, foundational model, people say that you need to ground the model in truth. So they grounded in truth, and they often say grounded is another way to say retrieval augmented generation.
Right. I mean, I do like the technical jargon, though. I think it helps us understand. I think the lawyers appreciate that more than other folk.
Yeah. Words matter. Lawyers know that.
Yeah. And, you know, so in the intro, which some people I know skip past, so just a refresher, there's no legal ethics opinions given on this podcast. But because of what you just described and how there are lawyers using Vincent AI right now because its accuracy is there, it makes me think about the model rules, particularly comment 5 to rule 1.5, which I'm jumping to the end here, where it states a lawyer should not exploit a fee arrangement based primarily on hourly charges by using wasteful procedures. So my question for you, Damien, is if lawyers are not using Vincent AI or these other AI tools and billing time, are they engaged in wasteful procedures? In your non-legal ethics opinion, what do you think about that?
That's something I've been thinking about a lot because we've been here before. That is, I've been practicing law since 2002. And it used to be in 2002, you would send a paper letter to the other side. And people would say, no, you can't use email because there's an ethical breach there. Because with email, that goes along a bunch of servers. And along any of those servers, it could actually be eavesdropped. And there's security concerns. So you can't use email. And then a few years later, there's an ethics opinion saying that if you don't use email, you're wasting the client's money, right? And similarly, you know, if you didn't go to the books in 2002 and be able to go to the stacks and be able to do this, my librarians would say, you're doing it wrong because you need to go to the stacks to do this. And now, and then a few years later, there's an ethics opinion saying that if you use book research instead of electronic research, you're wasting the client's money. Same way with TAR on e-discovery. You know, there's it used to be, no, I need to have eyes on every single document because if you don't, you're breaching your ethical duties. A few years later, there's a bunch of judicial opinions saying if you're not using TAR, that is the automated e-discovery, you're wasting your client's money. So we've seen this before in many, many instances. And so I think you're right that if it took me 4 hours to do a research task and Vincent AI can do it in a minute and a half, and of course, then you read through the cases and then, you know, maybe it takes 15 minutes instead of 4 hours. That differential between 4 hours and 15 minutes, are you wasting those 3 hours and 45 minutes of the client's time? And how long is it going to be before you actually see that judicial opinion saying that, yes, indeed, if you're not doing this with retrieval augmented generation, you are wasting the client's money.
Yeah. And then what is a lawyer to do, right? Because if you're just billing time and you used to have a 10-hour task, you charge $500 an hour, you make $5,000 for that 10-hour task. Now with a tool like Vincent AI, it might take you 10 minutes. So that's 0.2, right? You would have to 50x your rate, right? You would have to 50x your rate. And no client's going to want to pay that, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And no client's going to want to pay that. And I would say the other part of this is we've been thinking from the lawyer's perspective, think from the client's perspective. ChatGPT has the massive adoption, the biggest, the quickest adoption of any legal tech, or not any legal tech, of any technology ever, right? So your client is probably using ChatGPT right now. So is your client going to put up with you spending 4 hours on this and saying, hey, your competitor on the street did this in 15 minutes. I'm not going to put up with you doing 4 hours. So we should maybe go from thinking of it from a lawyer's perspective and think of it from the client's perspective. What are they going to put up with? And I would say because so many clients are using ChatGPT, they're going to put up with a lot less.
And so this goes into something that I heard you talk about towards the end of your interview on Pioneers and Pathfinders, and that is the changing model of big law. Because the way to solve these problems in the past was hire more lawyers and throw more lawyers at the problem. And that's also the only way you can make more money on the billable hour model. There's only so many hours in a day. You have to hire more lawyers. And that's how you get to that. But with tools like this that are so quick and efficient, you don't necessarily need more lawyers, right?
That's right.
The solo attorney like myself can come in and get to quick results. This is what these clients are going to, if they're not already expecting it, they're going to be expecting it really soon. So if I'm a big law firm, or worse for the big law firm, if I'm an associate at a big law firm and I have this light bulb moment, what am I doing grinding the hours in big law? What do you think the future holds for big law with this technology? When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show.
Yeah, we for a century have worked under the Cravath model, which is you have partner at the top and you have a pyramid of now a bunch of associates underneath that partner churning away hours and generating revenue for that partner. That has been the Cravath model that we've had for over 100 years. And so now that cravath model maybe is threatened, and threatened by three scenarios that I'm going to go through. Scenario one is the historical cravath model, where I, as an in-house client, reach out to my law firm partner, ask a legal question. Law firm partner then assigns an associate. Associate churns away for 4 hours, and then we partner gives the answer back. Maybe takes 2 days, costs maybe $5,000, right? That's the old model. And then the partner's happy because they made $5,000. So that's scenario one. Scenario two is the partner doesn't ask the associate. The partner asks their trusty Vincent AI or other large language model. And it's not going to take 2 days turnaround. It's going to take 20 seconds turnaround. And it doesn't maybe take $5,000 worth of work. Maybe it takes less than $5,000, right? So does that partner actually need a human associate? Or do you just need your trusty large language model associate to be able to do this work? So that's scenario two. Scenario three is the in-house counsel that was asking the question might do what the partner did and just ask their trusty large language model associate to do that work. And then they don't have to call the partner, and it's not going to cost $5,000. It's going to cost a fraction of a penny. So I, as an external law firm person, have to think, what value am I providing that in-house counsel that the in-house counsel can't do with the large language model itself and the tools that we're building itself? So you have to build a value added. And what is that value? It's your human expertise. It's you being able to talk the client off the ledge. It's you being able to say, now, listen, you're focused on this, but you shouldn't be focused on this. These are things that the machines right now can't do, but you can provide value on top of that. So why does the in-house lawyer call you instead of asking their large language model associate? It's for your human expertise. And so that's why I think your subscriber models, that is your listeners that are focusing on this, that is the value you're providing. You're not providing the legal research output. You're providing the counseling. And truly, we are called counselors. We are counseling humans. Machines cannot yet counsel. That's the value you're providing. You're not providing the widget that is the legal research.
If I may even take it a step further, I think that is the death of the outside counsel for clients and customers who have in-house counsel, where there is massive market opportunity in the latent legal market. So lawyers should not be worried. Is all the businesses that are not and will never be large enough to hire full-time in-house counsel. This is where fractional general counsel, which is something that I do, comes into play on the subscription model, which is the same way that they would pay a full-time in-house attorney. It's just less at a fraction because their needs, their legal needs, are fractional by comparison. Right? So like there's massive, I'm not worried about competition because there's so much market opportunity with that business out there. But the big law model is too bloated to serve that latent legal market in that way.
I would agree with you. And I would also build upon that to say that I, as an in-house counsel, have a limited amount that the business will spend on bringing somebody in-house. That is, it's really hard for me to bring somebody in-house. So having a fractional in-house person, like you've just described, is actually a really good model for me as an in-house person. Be able to say, okay, if times get tough with my business and I don't have to fire this in-house person, I could just be able to say, hey, we're going to use less of your fractional services going forward, right? So this offsets my risk. That's thing number one. And thing number two, yeah, I think that there is going to be a lot of latent demand, that is a latent legal market, both in what we just described in the corporate market and then going down market to the access to justice gap, where 80% of legal needs are unmet because lawyers are too expensive. Like, we don't want to roll out of bed for what a regular person can pay for us. There was a joke when I was an associate at a law firm is that none of us associates could afford ourselves. That is, our rates were too much for us to hire ourselves to do our work. So if we can't, as upper middle class associates, do afford ourselves, what hope does the average middle class person have to be able to afford people like us? So if you are able to do a 4-hour legal task in a minute and a half, maybe you can actually go down market and be able to serve that massive latent legal market that is being unserved. They want to pay us money. They just can't pay us enough. So maybe you can make up in volume and be able to say, now I can serve more of these people and make more money because now I'm tapping into this legal market.
Since humanity entered the industrial age, though, there's always been this concern, right, that new technology is going to take away jobs. And what always comes to mind for me in this situation was like the voice machine. Right. Where like AT&T suppressed the technology for decades because they were worried that, well, people could just record messages. Nobody's going to be making phone calls anymore. But what they wouldn't think about was the latent market of people who aren't using phone systems because it's maybe inefficient. You can't get somebody on the other line. And all it did was when this technology finally came out, the people who used phone systems and voice messages, voice recorders skyrocketed, right? So I think there's so much opportunity that there's really not something this profession should be scared about. going back to like this big
to put a pin on that. So what you've just described is the technical term for that is Jevons paradox. And so the Jevons paradox is much like the example you gave, which was a good one. There's another example of, for example, LED light bulbs. That LED light bulbs, everyone thought, oh, this is amazing. We'll be able to save all this money. But what do? We actually keep the lights on longer because it's cheaper, right? So there's a paradox with the cheaper and more accessible things in, the more it's used. That's called Jevons paradox. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way, I think that, yes, as we have it cheaper, faster, better, stronger, middle class, we can go down market and be able to actually tap into that market. So actually the pie expands in that way. And then also the pie expands with the upmarket. So my friend Darth Vaughn at Ford has said, you as a law firm have no idea how much work I don't give to you because you're too damn expensive. He said, do you realize how regulated I am? And there's all sorts of regulations I'm not giving to you because you're too expensive. He said, if you use large language models in the way that they should be used, I will give you way more work because I have more work than can be done at this point. So Jevons paradox says, if you shrink your rates, people like Ford will hire you more. And then people down market will build more.
But shrinking rates still might not make you, you could bring in more business, but if you change your model and you reprice that, then you're incentivized to scale and do more work and take on more clients. And it's not going to take you more time. So you could actually make more money if you lower your rates and stop billing time and productize your legal services, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And then I misspoke there. I didn't even mean to say rates. I said, if you lower your unit cost maybe a better way to say it, is that yes, if you go to flat fee, if you go to subscription, if you essentially reduce the amount per unit that you provide to the customer, then you can make way more money.
Yeah. And you know, with these larger businesses, if they are going to hire fractional outside counsel, they know their legal needs on an ongoing basis, more so than maybe these small business owners do. Because it is hard to price in this market, I will tell you, on subscription, right? But these larger companies, these enterprise clients, they have the data. And they would probably love pricing certainty. And I've been trying to get into like Clock and Talk and, you know, in front of Clock and these other groups. They think I have something to sell, but I don't. I'm a practicing attorney serving the latent legal market. But like trying to help them see the light. And I think eventually it's just a matter of time before they do. But I do want to come back to something because I know you have a really other interesting graphic, and it goes back to this big law model not working. And part of the reason I think that is because of lawyers, even though it's a tight market right now, so you can't even hire lawyers. But if you do, they're really expensive. So if you don't have to hire them, then you reduce your costs. How about you tell us about reducing costs and increasing profitability?
Yes, of course. And so if we think about, you know, I practiced for 15 years. And so when I did so, I was almost exclusively on the hourly model. And when people in the hourly model just think about revenue, they just say, how much did I bring in last quarter, last month, last year, right? They just think about revenue. They almost never think about cost like they should be thinking about cost. And so, but if you think about cost, you realize, yeah, we got a bunch of revenue here, but our profit on this was next to zero. Or maybe we actually lost money on this case because it cost more money than we brought in revenue. So this profit versus cost is something that hourly people don't think about. But if you move to the flat fee or subscription model or contingency fee model, you know very well that if you push down the cost, you can actually really increase your profit. That is, if you charge the same, you could actually now make more money. And now that you have that increased profit margin, you can actually say to the client, hey, listen, I'll actually shrink the cost of what I would charge you and give you a subscription or give you a flat fee. And the client says, wait, I get to have certainty with a subscription or certainty with a flat fee, and you would charge me less than you would charge me hourly? Sign me up. So there's incentive from the client to jump on that bandwagon. And there's also incentive for you because now, look, you make way more money with your profit margins than you would have with this hourly model. And so when we think about the lawyers, you know, I worked on a plaintiff side. I did a lot of plaintiff side antitrust work. So we would often sue over price fixing. And so the way a price fixing cabal would be is that all the business would say, you say, here's the set price, right? And then inevitably, one of those businesses would drop their price. And when that business would drop their price, they would get all the customers. All the market share would flow into them because their price was lower. And then inevitably, the other customer, the other businesses would drop their price too to be able to bring in some of that market share. So using that analogy, we as a lawyer, that is we as a legal profession, have been not in a price fixing cabal, but instead in an hourly billing cabal, where everybody gives kind of lip service to flat fees. We give lip services to subscription models. But if you were to ask the most honest of these law firms, only 10-15% of their work is actually flat fee and the rest is hourly. So if we move from this hourly cabal to a flat fee or subscription-based model, that company number one, that firm number one, is going to bring in all the market share. All the customers are going to flow to them because the customers are going to get certainty in their rates. And they're also going to get more cheaper cost to them. And then on the lawyer side, of course, all the lawyers are incentivized to shrink their cost to be able to increase their profit. So once firm number one does that, they're going to get all the market share. They're going to get all the customers. And then all the other law firms fall into line and say, oh, I guess we're going to have to do this too. So the question is, do you want to be the first law firm that jumps into this flat fee subscription model and get all the market share? Or do you want to be the last law firm that does this after everybody else does? And I think the answer there is obvious. If you're in the price fixing, you want to be the first to drop your price. And if you're in the law firm, you also want to be the first to go to the subscription model or flat fee model.
And if that didn't convince you and you're not already registered to go to ABA Tech Show, Stephanie Everett and I have a presentation that's basically all around that exact argument. So please come to ABA Tech Show in Chicago in February of 2024 and come to our CLE on that, because, well, that's a great concise version of our 1 hour CLE. That is, I feel like you can dedicate hours and hours to that subject, but that's an incredibly concise way to put it. Thank you, Damien. I mean, there's so much more to cover and we only have so much more time. I'm curious to know, what does this mean for legal education in your opinion?
I think that the cravath model crumbling, like we just talked about the cravath model crumbling, where you used to have the pyramid of one partner and of a whole bunch of associates under that partner. If that goes away and I as a partner don't need six associates underneath me, but instead I just need maybe one associate underneath me, or maybe zero associates underneath me. Maybe we move to a one partner, one matter kind of model. What does that mean for incoming associates? That is, how many associates are we going to need going forward? And then if we don't need associates, what does that mean for legal education? That is, if I'm the smartest of the smartest college graduates that is thinking about applying to law school, I'm going to look at the associate hire rate for these law firms crumbling. And, you know, right now, I don't know what the numbers are, but let's just say that, you know, the odds of landing a big law job out of law school, let's say it's 1 in 100 today under the cravath model. If it shrinks from 1 in 100 to 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000, right? If I'm a smart college graduate thinking about going to law school, am I going to take those odds? Or am I going to say, forget that, I'm going to get an MBA instead. I'm going to be able to do something else. So if I'm a law firm, or I'm sorry, a law school, I'll be thinking really hard about this to be able to say, you know, my pipeline of customers, students, will be shrunk dramatically if we don't do something dramatically different. If maybe I'm giving law firms too much, or I'm sorry, maybe I'm giving law schools too much credit, because the number of law schools that are thinking this way is very rare. Yeah. And they've been making a lot of money for many years on the naivety of incoming law students. And, you know, I was asked at one point to be a professor at a law school. And I thought of this almost as an ethical dilemma, because I know that all these bright-eyed people would be spending between $150,000 and $200,000 on this legal education and getting jobs that are worth $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000, yes, and all of their hopes and dreams. And that would be my salary that they're paying to be able to have their hopes and dreams dashed. So I saw this as an ethical dilemma. That was back in the, you know, early 2000s. And now I see that as even more of an ethical dilemma. If the law firms are, I'm sorry, the law schools are promising big law jobs that will be devastated with these cravath models going away, they're essentially selling, they've been selling hopes and dreams for years, and that will increase as our large language models take over.
Yeah, I mean, I wish what you said wasn't so true. And I wish somebody told me that before I went to law school. I'm very glad I landed where I did, but I know a lot of my colleagues are not, right? Especially those, you know, getting six figures in debt and then making 50K, you know, for the first 2 or 3 years, which still happened when I graduated in 2014. And another problem that our profession has in terms of the talent pipeline is even Bill Gates was recently quoted in an article about the possibility of a 3-day work week where machines can take care of so many things. Who's going to want to build their time and work 5 to 7 days a week when all these other industries are going to 3, 4, and 3-day work weeks? Right.
That's right.
Like we have a talent problem there too.
One of my smartest friends who is an associate with me at my law firm, he's now a judge, but he said that we're in the wrong profession as law because if I were to create a restaurant, I wouldn't be working my butt off. What I would do is I would hire managers and I would hire people to do this. And then I would go to the Caribbean and spend some time and they would make money because I'm not exchanging time for money like lawyers exchange time for money. Like every other business leverages other ways, large language models or otherwise, to be able to say, my time is not my money. And lawyers should do the same thing.
I think, because I actually think lawyers are some of the smartest people on the planet, that if we did not have the option to bill time, if that was taken away from us, say an ethical bar or something, I think you would see some of the most creative and successful business models than in any other industry. What do you think?
Yeah, I 100% agree. And yeah, so the odds of that happening, we can talk about the odds, but I agree that if you were to take away the option of the hourly business model, yes, lawyers are really smart at being able to figure out how to make money. And so I think that, you know, the odds of the ABA or any of the state bars essentially prohibiting hourly, that's next to zero, I would say. But going back to the price fixing cabal that I talked about earlier, the odds of maybe the first mover advantage, where it's some of the lawyers that get it and figure out that, yes, I should be doing subscription models. Yes, I should be doing flat fee models because I can make way more money. The smartest of the smart will go to that model first. So we don't even need an ethical bar on the hourly model. I think lawyers will get it as our large language models take over.
I am somewhat of an optimistic capitalist at times, and I do think economic forces will eventually win out, right?
Yeah. That's right. I talked to many, many law firms, and I talked to the board of directors for one of the biggest law firms in the world in Manhattan, where they make billions of dollars in revenue each year. And I gave that description that I gave just in your podcast just now. And the chair of the board said, yes, of course. Of course, this is the future, right? Because we can make more money this way, right? And so if the biggest law firms in the world are thinking this way, your listeners should be too.
Right. Wow. Well, that's sort of a nice... That's a nice bow for me on tying up this conversation. There was one more thing, though, I know you wanted to make sure my listeners were aware of when it comes to Sally. So how about with the time we have left, you tell my listeners about that?
Yeah, Sally, S-A-L-I, is a legal data standard. I think ISO, but for the law. And so this is a legal data standard that's being used by Thomson Reuters, by LexisNexis, by Bloomberg, by my company, VLex, as well as iManage, NetDocuments, and as well as some of the largest law firms in the world. And as well as some of the biggest corporations in the world, so Microsoft, Intel, they're all using this legal data standard to be able to say, we as an industry are counting things like motions for summary judgment for breach of contract in the Southern District of New York. Each one of those is a Sally tag. Also, we're counting things like merger agreement with force majeure clause. Each of those is a Sally tag. And so all of the companies I just mentioned, Thomson Reuters, Lexis, VLex, we're all using Sally to allow you as a law firm to be able to be interoperable between all of these. So if you tag your motions to dismiss with Sally tags, you could be able to pull those from my company, VLex. And then you could also use that same tag to be able to pull it from Thomson Reuters and from LexisNexis and from NetDocuments and from iManage. So essentially everyone in the ecosystem is calling the things the same thing. And that does two things. Number one, it gives you a much better taxonomy for you as a company to say, you as a law firm to say, we did this document before. Let's find that document like this new thing that I need to do. Sally tags are a way to be able to tag up your documents, to be able to say, here's the exact time that we've done this thing in the past. So finding that from your data set is thing number one. But thing number two is that if you haven't done a thing like that, you can come to my company like VLex and say, I can see every motion to dismiss for breach of contract in front of Judge Smith in the Southern District of New York. And because we use Sally tags, you could be able to essentially have a universal brief bank for every brief that's ever been filed before this judge in this court. And then on the transactional side, if you work with, you know, another company, and we have lots, Sally has lots of contractual side transactional, they could say, show me all the merger agreements in this industry that have force majeure clauses in this jurisdiction. Each of those is a Sally tag. And so you could be able to pull as a brief bank or as a contract precedent database in a way that you haven't been in the past. And the other benefit, so that's benefit number one, is finding the things that matter. Benefit number two is that you reduce your vendor lock-in. That is the duopoly of legal tech vendors, which I'm not going to say their names, but they've made lots of money over the years with their paywalled taxonomy. That is, they have their taxonomy and no one else can use that taxonomy. And so that you're locked in to that vendor because of that taxonomy. When I talked to one of the duopoly, they said about Sally and saying, hey, you should have this interoperable standard. That duopoly member said, well, if we do that, people can move from us to my competitor much more easily. And I said, well, you know, the door goes both ways. They can move from your competitor to you more easily too. And I said, build better stuff, but I didn't say stuff. And so the whole point of this is that Sally reduces vendor lock-in, so that you can move from vendor one to vendor two to vendor three, because everyone is using the same language for this. The taxonomy is no longer the moat that keeps vendor one from moving to vendor two. So in this way, look at Sally, because odds are we at Sally are counting the things that you think matter, and motions, motion types, also business models. We have subscription fee model as a thing that we're counting, flat fee model. We have collared rates. We have all sorts of business of law things too. So take a look at Sally because it's being used industry-wide. It is free. It is open source. Sally is a nonprofit. I'm a volunteer for that nonprofit. Everything we're doing is free and open source. So this is not me selling something. This is me offering something for free to all of your listeners to be able to say, maybe jump on the Sally bandwagon because everybody else is.
And certainly this should not have been billable time stuff anyway to bill your clients. But when you're already using alternative fees, saving time and efficiency matters a lot. And this sounds like a massive potential time saver.
That's right. Especially if the finding a thing like mine that I did before that maybe I could do in this new thing. So that finding is a waste of time. And if you could be able to expedite that by tagging up the things that you've done before and be able to more easily pull it in, that is time savings that your subscription fee model people are going to be much, much better for. And then if you haven't done that thing in the past, being able to go to vendors and be able to say, here are other motions that have won in front of my judge, or here are other merger agreements, and be able to use Sally Tag to find those things, massive time savings.
Yeah. So the reason why I get all my listeners to stay through to the end of the episode is because they're curious to know how you're going to answer this question, Damien, and that is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
I've done hundreds of podcasts since the beginning of the pandemic. I've never been asked that question before. So with that, I do not have a pat answer. I would say that my well-reasoned answer that I'm happy to say I'm wrong about, but at least my answer as of this point is that it is indeed a sandwich because it is a piece of meat between two pieces of bread. But I'm happy to have my mind changed on that.
Compilation episode coming soon with everyone's answers. So then the listeners can decide who had the right one. And then if people wanted to follow up with you or learn more about VLEX, what's the best way for them to do that?
Sure. So I'm on LinkedIn all the time. That's first name, last name on LinkedIn. I'm also on Twitter quite a bit. So I'm now known as X, of course. It's first name, last name is my handle. And yeah, then VLEX.com is where VLEX lives.
All right. Great. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.